And may it please the court. We're here on a class action appeal that involves over 50,000 retirees and dependents who are insured by HMSA and who are receiving constitutionally inadequate, inferior benefits provided by the EUTF. This appeal presents three issues. First, when do benefits vest and accrue under Article 16, Section 2, which I'll call Section 2. Second, at what level are those benefits vested and accrued? And in this case, was there an unconstitutional diminishment or impairment? And embedded in that question is whether Judge Castagnetti could have decided that question summarily. And if she did she decide correctly in light of the conflicting experts' declarations? And finally, were there aspects of Judge Hefo's decision in the underlying appeal under Chapter 91, which were never appealed by the EUTF, that are to be given preclusive effect? Judge Castagnetti said no, and I submit that the correct answer was yes. In fact, Judge Castagnetti erred on all three of those issues. In effect, she decided that benefits vest and accrue upon retirement. She ignored not only Justice Acoba's concurrence, in the Everson case, where he said that they accrue when someone is first hired and becomes a member of the retirement system, but also she ignored the teachings of the Supreme Court in Kaho'ohanahano, where in the context of an appeal regarding the impairment of funding for the ERS, the Supreme Court analyzed the standing of individual retirees and spoke to the question whether they had vested and accrued rights, and said there that their rights vest and accrue upon employment and continue in effect as they go through the system through a period of years, ultimately culminating in retirement.
Mr. Alston, would it be fair to say that the benefits accrue at the time that the state or county employee enters the ARS, subject to the conditions that must be satisfied to receive the benefits?
At the time of employment, that's right.
Right. So in other words, there's something there at the beginning, but if they terminate or die before they get to 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, whatever the mark is, or they don't get anything.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
So that, for example, as they get to 5 years or 10 years, and the legislature has properly moved the goal line, not necessarily fairly, but properly moved the goal line prospectively.
And from time to time, I think we get that point.
Yeah, and it's from time to time it says you have to work longer to get the same benefit. And so what I'm saying is, you know, the right accrues upon hiring, and you are protected in that right once you reach the milestone, whether it's the period at which you get half benefits or 75% benefits or 100% benefits. And so here, what we say is that, as Justice Acoba said in his concurrence, what that protects is the high watermark in terms of health benefits during the course of the employee's tenure with the state or the county.
Okay, so I'm familiar with what Justice Acoba said in the concurrence in Everson, but that was a justice of one, and
right.
And I'm glad he gave us some guidance. But what is your authority for picking the high water mark?
In Kaho'ohanahana, the Supreme Court endorsed the readings of the Alaska constitutional provision, which mirrors very closely the Hawaii constitutional provision. And in a series of cases, Hammond, Galleon, and Duncan, the Alaska Supreme Court has addressed issues around this. And in Duncan, finally in 2003, came to the point of saying, you get the best of the best. And if there are to be changes, then the benefits that go down have to be offset by improvements. And it also said that Even if generally for the class as a whole, things are fair, if any individual employee is harmed by a change which is a detriment to him or her, he or she individually has standing to come and say, wait, stop. My benefits used to be better, now they're worse. And, you know, I lost coverage for cancer.
Right.
So that's, it's weaving those together.
Right, but it didn't, but Duncan, just to be clear, Duncan specifically overruled the Alaska Supreme Court's earlier decision that you focus on the individual employee as opposed to the group,
right,
when assessing what benefits they're entitled to. I know I'm familiar with what you said, but we look at the benefits as applied to the group, correct?
Correct.
And that's what you're arguing to this court as
well. That's right. That's the starting point. You look first at the group, and you look at, and it, you know, nobody suggests that health benefits should be frozen in time so that the state-of-the-art technology as of 1980 or 1985 is embedded forever into a health care plan. I mean, obviously, the industry changes, and the industry changes in ways that none of us can predict and probably none of us like. But the reality is that the health benefits that are provided to employees through time has to evolve along with the health care industry. And so, yes, you do look at the good, the bad, and you assess the total impact. And so here, Judge Castagnetti erred in saying that I'm going to assess what retirees were getting, in the last gasp of the PEHF compared to what they're getting now. Because what she should have looked at instead did employees as a group or as a subgroup have better benefits at some point during their employment? And were they harmed then by the transition into the EUTF system?
Would that necessitate, though, since you're representing 50,000 retirees and dependents, the trial judge to examine each of those individually? Because you're also suggesting that the analysis, and Justice Okoba partially said it, but the analysis is you look at the plan on a group basis,
right,
but you look at the entitlement to the benefit on an individual basis. So how do we come up with a decision that melds those two together? The state comes up with one formulation, but I'm not sure that the plaintiffs have come up with one other than to say, well, Justice Okoba said this.
No, actually, Judge Cahill, there is not a circumstance that is reflected in the record where any individual employee,
right,
suffered while others thrive.
Right.
What we have is group decisions, and we're content to address this on a group level.
Okay.
But I would submit that you need to look at subgroups as well as the group as a whole. Because with respect to certain unions, as we know, their high,
right,
watermark was up here,
right,
while the non-union workers were, down here.
Okay, but since you raised the issue of the unions, Mr. Alston, those benefits were negotiated and provided by the union, correct? That was not what the health fund did not provide. They funded the plans, but they didn't. Those were not health fund plans.
Correct.
I mean, and also, isn't it true that retirees never had union plans?
That is true.
Okay.
Retirees were always taken. I mean, workers in the union plans were always taken at the point of retirement out of that union plan and put into the base retiree plan.
Right.
And there are two possible outcomes here. I mean, obviously, for us, the grand slam home run would be for you to say, if you were ever in a union plan, you stay in a union plan forever until you die. But even if you don't accept that argument, and the Alaska Supreme Court's decision in Galleon supports that view, because in Galleon, there was a situation where the retirement system had three different funds with three different groups of employees working side by side, and two of them were, as I recall, two of them were solvent and one wasn't, and they rated the solvent plan to help the other plan, and the court said you can't do that. The corollary to that is you can't do the same thing. But let's assume you reject that. And let's assume that we're just talking about the fate of all retirees under the pre-EUTF plan and now under the EUTF. The question is, you know, what do you judge their benefits to be, and has there been an impairment? And this weaves into what Judge Hefo decided in the Chapter 91 appeal, because she found that there was impairment, there was...
Okay, well, before we get to Judge Hefo's decision, I think it's really important to decide to look at what that case was. Judge Hefo was sitting an appeal from an agency action. And so we have to look at what was before the agency, because that the operative pleading, if you will, was what was the four questions posed to the agency. And I think it's very useful to look at those questions, because they inform this court on how we treat Judge Hefo's decision thereafter.
And in part, of course, the EUTF refused to consider all those questions.
Correct, but Chapter 87 was not among those questions. It was 87A and the Constitution.
True, and in assessing the constitutional issues, Judge Hefo found that there was a violation of Section 2 by the lack of parity and the inferior benefits. But that's not where I was trying to go yet. Let's go back to the sort of the basic question is, did Judge Castagnetti err in finding that the benefits that people received in the last days of the PEHF were approximately what they are now? I would suggest that because of our high watermark argument, that's too simplistic. But even if you accept that as the appropriate line of analysis, the problem with her decision and the problem with her deciding it on summary judgment is that there were conflicting declarations from the experts. Our expert said, absolutely, there are inferior benefits. Their expert, in a declaration that was conclusory and without any sort of detailed analysis, said they're just as good or better. And what Judge Castagnetti said was, I find they're about the same, okay? And the problem with her decision in that regard is really twofold. I mean, one is, she takes a very short list of examples and says they look the same to me. That, I submit, was not the kind of robust analysis that our expert did and the kind of robust analysis that was necessary. Second, and more importantly, and actually more easily decided, is the fact that under the PEHF, the plan that was available to all workers, it had two parts. There was the HMSA base part, which is what Judge Castagnetti compared. And on top of that, there was the major medical component, which provided additional benefits for people, actives and retirees and like. And what Judge Castagnetti looked at was the base plan. She ignored our expert's 2013 declaration. She ignored the fact that when you meld the base and the major medical plan together, what happens is there were much higher rates of reimbursement across the board for the benefit of the employees, active and retirees alike. And
Mr. Alston, let me interject for a minute, because we're spending a lot of time talking about damages, so to speak, on summary judgment standard, which obviously is problematic. I'd like to turn your attention more to what I'll call the liability argument. Okay, and my question is, your argument is that active and retired benefits should be the same or substantially similar, and I'd like you to break down for me, if you can, how much of that flows from HRS 87 statutory language, versus how much of your argument or position flows from the pamphlets, literature, or other representations that were, allegedly made by the state. Because I'm having, going through the record, I was having a hard time sorting that out.
Okay. Both Chapter 87 and the pamphlets independently standing alone support our argument. Chapter 87 supports our argument because under 87-22, The PEHF was required to make any prospective plan available to all employees. All employees under Chapter 87 was defined as including not only active workers, but also retired workers. And so when the statute says everybody gets the benefit of the plan, that by definition means you don't create a separate lower plan for retirees.
Yeah, but the statute doesn't say always.
What?
But the statute doesn't say always, right? I mean, statutes change, right?
Statutes change, but under Article 16, Section 2, it cannot change with respect to the health benefits that have vested and accrued.
Okay.
They can't be diminished.
They can't be diminished. And right. So when at the point of retirement, somebody, the EUTF or the PEHF comes and says, okay, well, thank you for your decades of loyal service. Now step down over here and get your and take your inferior package. That's what Chapter 87 forbade. And in the same way, the pamphlets and other notices, which the Supreme Court in Chun said were the kinds of things that get great weight, when they said your benefits will continue, that means not your benefits will continue at half, or your benefits will be diminished to half. It means you continue to receive what you've gotten all along. I'm sorry, just...
No. My question is this, though. If we conclude that the Constitution protects benefits and not parity of benefits between retirees and active employees, do you still have a claim against the state?
Yes.
Okay. And I know you don't have a lot of time, so I would really like it if you would address that.
Yes. Because we have used the concept of historical parity because that's what Chapter 87 always did. And we provided the declarations of Mr. Murakami, who's now, by the way, on the EUTF board, and Mel Higa, who was also at PEHF, to say all along, always, that it was parity. But even if all you're doing is protecting benefits, then the package of benefits that was provided under the PEHF does set, you know, the benchmark against which all arguments about diminishment or impairment have to be assessed.
So your argument is parity as to actives and retirees, or parity between what the retirees currently get and what they got under the 2001 system.
Actually, what I would say is the high mark
of their career. Okay.
Right. When they were employed, when they were members, what was the high mark? What was the best package of benefits they received?
How could that possibly be implemented on a group health plan basis?
Because this is not a situation where any employee was standing alone,
right,
covered by a particular package of benefits. There were large groups of thousands of, or tens of thousands of employees, and so it's not a matter of saying, you know, does John K. Aloha,
okay,
today, is he getting the same thing he had? Because he is just one of many thousands in one group or another.
So the analysis is still on a group basis.
Indeed.
And the EUTF has the power to negotiate,
right,
for health benefit plans on a group basis, not on an individual basis.
And that's an incredibly important point, because if you look at the testimony of Mr. Garner, their expert,
right,
what he did was that he acknowledges that with respect to Kaiser, they underwrote the plan for retirees as part of a single pool with active workers, and everybody continued and continues to this day seamlessly. It's only with respect to HMSA where they decided that they were going to cut the benefits for retirees. They were going to add to the benefits for active workers. And they did that not because they couldn't have done as they did with Kaiser and rate everybody in a single pool and keep under the caps, but they decided it would be a good idea to do it that way.
But you're not claiming that constitutionally a retiree or an active employee has the right to have two plans available to them, an HMSA and a Kaiser plan.
They have the right to choose if they're being offered.
If so, the state could eliminate this entire problem by simply dispensing with HMSA as a whole and putting everybody into Kaiser, if that were practically and economically feasible?
We don't need to get there.
Okay, you're right.
My inclination is
but that would cause a big problem for the plaintiffs.
That would cause a big problem, and it probably doesn't work from the standpoint of impairment or diminishment.
Okay, all right. That's what I wanted to know.
So I won't go any further.
Okay.
My time's up for now.
Thank you.
Rest of the other questions.
One quick question as a follow-up to Judge Leonard's question. And apparently, you do recognize there can be a disparity between what's provided to the retirees and active and still not violate the anti-diminution constitutional provisions. Am I correct on that?
No, I don't know. I'm sorry. If I said that or anything that supported that, what I don't believe there can be a discrepancy if historically there was not a discrepancy.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Deputy Attorneys General Deirdre Marie Iha, Donna Kalama, and Brian Alvarano for the state defendants. Also present in court today is counsel from all four of the counties. Your Honors, I'd like to start with Everson because Everson defines the benefit that's protected by Article 16, Section 2, and is also why Judge Castagnetti was not wrong in using the health funds retiree plans as the benchmark by which diminishment must be measured. These are words taken from Everson itself. Everson defines the benefit protected by Article 16, Section 2 as a retired employee's health benefits that are included in a health benefits plan, that is, the health benefits provided by a carrier. This is a discussion at pages 417 to 418 of the opinion. This holding means that Everson tells us how to conduct the comparison by which diminishment is measured. The only health benefits plan, health benefits included in a health benefits plan provided by a carrier that any retiree received prior to the 2003 switch to the EUTF were the health fund plans, the health fund retiree plans. That is why we start there. It has nothing to do with accrual. We started there because that's where Everson told us to start. And that's why Judge Castagnetti started there for purposes of the analysis. In terms of the switch, the important thing to realize about the HMSA plans is that when the switch happened, HMSA did not want to provide the base plus major medical anymore. They told the EUTF, which was just then starting up, these are old, obsolete systems. You are our last client who uses this, and we don't want to keep these old systems for you anymore. We want you to switch to a modern PPO plan, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. And so the EUTF said, okay, we understand, provide us with a plan that is of the same value as the previous plan. And that is what the EUTF sought out.
Now, I want to stop you there for just a minute because the briefs talk about actuarial value, mm-hmm. which seems to be linked to premiums as opposed to value to the beneficiary of the plan, and that's of concern because I get it, you have to have some flexibility because the state doesn't have unlimited money, but when we look at value, is it simply actuarial value or is there more that's promised here?
I think it's both, Your Honor. We propose actuarial equivalence the same way that the Duncan Court did, which is one measure, not the only one, but one measure of insurance plans' substantial equivalence.
Right. So you agree with Duncan, which said, yes, we can. That actuarial equivalence is a factor, but that's not. It's not the only factor. It's not a deciding factor.
You have
to look at more than just
as to the
actuarial equivalence.
Yeah, my apologies. As to the premiums, Your Honor, I don't think that's correct. Actuarial equivalence is not measuring how much it costs for the state or the individual to provide it, but the value of the plans. And this is explained in Mr. Garner's declaration, where he explains that what it is an evaluation of how often each of these services are used by this group, and at the end, the plan will have the same value to the group. So several of Your Honors asked questions about the focus on the group. That is absolutely correct, and in our view, focusing on the group is actually required by Hawaii law. And the case I point you to about that is Awakuni, where when Awakuni, granted it was a different context, but it is about the EUTF. And there's a portion of Awakuni that actually says that EUTF trustees must consider how the purchase of insurance plans works for the entire group. They cannot, they should not look at any one service by itself. In terms of the individual right, the reason that we start with the retired employees, the benefits provided, because Everson starts us there. The reason we focus on before and after is because logically, in order to determine diminishment, that's what you must do. You have to say something before and something after. The thing in the middle is whatever the plaintiffs have challenged. This is the case the plaintiffs brought. They said that the switch from the health fund to the EUTF is where the diminishment happened. So that's why we focus on before and after that. The union plans, Your Honor noted, were not run by the state. They were not negotiated by the state. The only thing the state did was provide funding which each of the union members chose. Mr. Alston is incorrect if to the extent he applied that any retiree was ever in any of those plans. The unions only ever offered them to active employees. So there's no dumping into a retiree plan. The retirees were always provided insurance from the health fund, always and only by the health fund, and now always and only by the EUTF. So the system that was ended was this split system, which caused a spiraling out of control cost because the state essentially was competing against itself in the purchase of insurance, which is why everything was consolidated together in the 2003 switch to the EUTF. When you talk about...
But they carved out the retirees when they did that.
No, Your Honor. The retirees are provided by the EUTF now as well.
I understand that.
Right.
But they carved out and gave them a different plan.
Now,
the propriety of that is one question.
Right.
The EUTF has a... The retirees get one benefit under HMSA, and the actives get a different one.
Well, the only plan that's really an issue here is the HMSA plan,
right.
And I think Judge Castagnetti says that clearly.
Right.
The reason that it has been, but it has always been rated separately. That is one thing
okay.
that's in the record, in the declarations, is even under the health fund, these were separate contracts rated separately with separate returns. These were, they might have been operating next to each other, but they're not the same thing. So the retirees, you have to remember, of course, that the...
Well, when you say that, though...
Yeah.
They're rated differently. So the amount that the state would pay for an individual employee
mm-hmm.
would depend on that person's age or when they came into the system, when they're in retirement. But the benefit that right. that retiree received was identical to the actives, right?
No, Your Honor.
Under the old system?
No, Your Honor, because
okay.
two-thirds of the active employees were not provided health insurance by the health fund. Two-thirds of the active employees were provided by the unions, where the state was not negotiating those contracts. We had no say about what the unions chose to cover or how.
Okay, but let's set aside, although Mr. Alston will object, but let's set aside for the moment the union plan, the union-sponsored plans, and just look at what the health fund offered to both active and retired employees,
mm-hmm.
which are all defined as employees under Chapter 87,
yes.
right? But Chapter 87-22 did say that all employees are entitled to the same benefits regardless of age, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that goes to Judge Cahill's point. And your brief wiggles around that a little bit, I think.
I don't think it does, Your Honor. I mean, with the wiggling. The Chapter 87, there are two provisions that the plaintiffs rely on. You have to remember, they have to show two things. What did the statute mean? The second thing is, can it bind the state 15 years after it was repealed? The two provisions they rely on were repealed by Act 89 in 2001. So the only way that these things can still bind the state is if they can rise to the level of a contract. Okay, so let's start with the statutory analysis. It does not say that they have to provide all the same benefits to the employees. Mr. Alston left out the phrase that Your Honor did say, which is regardless of age. And we say, based on both logic and the legislative history, regardless of age does not mean the same as regardless of pension status. We have two United States Supreme Court cases saying that those two things are logically distinct. And also, you don't always have to retire at the same age. I realize people assume that retirees are all the same age, but it's just not true. If you look at the state statutes, it's actually possible to retire a lot younger. You know, like I wish I could retire at that age. Some people can, depending on what job they were in, their years in service, how young they were when they started with the state. So when they say regardless of age, what they mean is that they can't do a program and give it to me because I'm young and healthy and not let an active employee get the same. And if they offer a plan to retirees, they can't say only the retirees under the age of 60 can have this. The only exception, which has been in the statutes from 1966, is the Medicare supplemental plan. And when you look at how the retirees have been handled before the switch and how after, this is incredibly, incredibly important. The Medicare supplemental plan has two major components, both the same before and after. If you are eligible for Medicare, you must sign up, and Medicare comes first. Those are the two things that are statutory. What comes after that is the very favorable Medicare coordination. So looking at these statutes, neither 8722B or 8727 says that the health fund had to provide exactly the same benefits to retirees as it does to actives. It does not say that, just based on its plain language. And going even further,
And I don't want to belabor this point because I think you do want to move on, but I do think that you're forgetting the first part of that phrase, which is all employees.
Right.
Those words exist just like regardless of age. So, but I think there's probably other issues you want to cover here.
But what's missing there, Your Honor, is a language that would be explicit enough to establish the contractual obligation that plaintiffs see there. Under Kalima, applying the National Railroad Test, the statutes not only have to be explicit about the legislature's desire to always bind itself forever, always forever, but also that specific contractual obligation. So to meet that standard, the statute would have to say retirees are always entitled to the same that actives have. That's how explicit it would have to be to meet that standard. And that standard is controlling Hawaii law about how to make these statutes still apply to us today, 15 years after they were repealed. So I think that's the reason that you can look at the statute, as we've argued, based on its plain language, is about regardless of age. It's not about regardless of retirement status. But even if you get past that, it's still not good enough. It doesn't meet the standard to make a contractual obligation that outlasts the statute itself.
Okay, so assuming we find that summary judgment wasn't appropriate because there was evidence for both sides, mm-hmm. how would you articulate the standard going back down?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Okay, so the point of error on appeal is that partial summary judgment was in error because there was a genuine issue of material fact.
Right.
In other words, both sides had competing experts that gave mm-hmm. evidence, and, you know, according to Mr. Alston, Judge Castagnetti favored your expert testimony over his expert testimony. If we, and I know you don't agree with that, mm-hmm. but if you do, and if this case is remanded, how would you articulate the standard for...
Well, based on the hypothetical you described, nothing about that ruling would change where I would start, which is to start with Everson. The retired and retired benefits that the retirees had in a health benefits plan provided by a carrier, the language right out of Everson. So I would start there. And then essentially Judge Castagnetti on remand would have to do the same thing she did before, which is to conduct a substantial equivalence analysis, pulling the test out of Duncan. We think that a substantial equivalence test has the right balance between providing some degree of stability for these benefits while also providing the flexibility that we all know health benefits plans must have. So we think that that test would be the right way to apply it. In terms of the hypothetical itself, I think what the plaintiffs are doing is they're disagreeing with the legal conclusion that Judge Castagnetti reached based on the facts. There is no dispute about what the health fund provided and no dispute about what the EUTF provided, and those are the material facts. And it doesn't establish a genuine issue of material fact to have a disagreement about what legal conclusion springs from those facts, as we've argued.
But both experts conclude that the plaintiff's expert says, well, they had it better before, and your expert says, well, they have it better now. And isn't that a factual question that only a trier of fact can decide after hearing the evidence?
I think you're looking at what are the material facts upon which they're basing that conclusion.
Well, they're basing them upon the same thing, but they're arriving at a different conclusion.
Right.
And the judge at the trial level accepted one of those conclusions over the other without having a trial. Now, maybe the same thing would happen. They'd come in and they'd go through their... For example, in Garner, in his declaration at paragraph 12, or 11, says that 12, in response to the RFP, so there was a request for a proposal, mm-hmm. HMSA proposed the PPO medical plan that it requested that it represented was actuarially equivalent to the PEHF's B plus MM plant.
Mm-hmm.
Garner accepted that HMSA provided an actuarial similar plan.
Well, as to that fact, Your Honor, we have basically put forth facts showing that offering an actuarial equivalent plan was exactly what the EUTF was set out to do.
I understand that, but your expert said nothing.
They said nothing. They did not respond. They did not put actuarial equivalence into contention
right.
because they did not contend either one of two things. that that actuarial equivalence is relevant. They didn't. They said nothing. They're silent right. in their summary judgment response. So on that point, I disagree. The record does not support a genuine issue of material fact on that question.
Okay.
Yeah.
But, counsel, part of what Judge Castagnetti decided, and I'm reading from her opinion, I don't know if I have a page cite, but she says, the court concludes that the differences in the levels of coverage as between the health fund and the EOTF HMSA plans for retirees are reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so isn't reasonableness really a question of fact when you're...
Not in this context, Your Honor. And I think the reason why is because it's a constitutional claim. So you look at other provisions of the Constitution, and they have, quite frankly, equally squishy tests. You know, your reasonable expectation of privacy under search and seizure, the rational basis test, almost anything to do with the First Amendment. I mean, there's stuff in there that's starting to sound like an appellate court reviewing a question of law has some judgment of its own to exercise. What Judge Castagnetti was doing there was applying a legal test. And she picked Duncan. Duncan's from Alaska. This court had said before, the Alaska provision's almost identical, that this is highly persuasive authority. So that's a legal test. And I understand that, you know, perhaps it lacks the precision we might have in other areas, but I think it's actually required for this area. And that's how the constitutional analysis works. You end up with tests that don't necessarily tell everything you might want to know, but that's the way it works. Your Honor, I'd like to turn to I'd like to go back, if I could, for a minute to the Kalima standard. Plaintiff's major arguments are premised on the statutes, like I said, that were repealed 15 years ago. Kalima describes the standard as an actual intent to bind itself. You also must have the contract for the particular contractual obligation at issue. So I would submit to you that even if you think these provisions that were repealed by Act 89 are vague, and even if they might have meant this, they're not clear enough. And that's what matters, because we're not talking about current law. We're talking about law that was repealed. Your Honor made a comment earlier about statutes change. That's correct. Statutes change because the job of the legislature is to articulate policy until a subsequent legislature articulates a different policy. And that's why buried within this is this separation of powers concern. If you read a contract into a statute that the legislature repealed, you are tying the hands of every subsequent legislature, even though that's not what they intended. So if that's what they wanted, they have to say so explicitly under this controlling law. I would submit to you that even if you are not exactly sure what the statutes might have meant, even if plaintiffs are part right, it is still not good enough because it can't meet the standard. And that's what matters for this, because these statutes have been gone a long time. Your Honors, we've argued, like we mentioned before, about the substantial similarity.
But a change in the statute can't diminish the employee's benefits, correct?
Well, in general, that's the premise of the case, Your Honor, yes. But in order to establish that they're entitled to something, they have to show either it's required by law or it's required by contract. It's not required by current law. We know this because the Everson Court already decided that. So then we have to decide, is it required by contract? It can't be required by Chapter 87. So they have to prove their entitlement. Once they prove they're entitled, that's what they're entitled to. That they can't get past the first step.
Everson said they were not entitled to parity under Chapter 87A.
That's correct. But I'm saying that if you want to base it on the old law, because it's not current, you have to follow the Kalima standard and find that it's a contract, because the legislature can always change the law. So we know, based on current law, we know the answer. But that's why the Kalima standard is relevant, because these are not current laws. They only can bind us today if they're contractual.
Are the plaintiffs asserting a contract claim? I don't think so.
No. Well, they're asserting generally. If you're asking if they're asserting an impairment of contract claim under the federal constitution, the answer is no.
Okay.
Well, there's one thing I wanted to highlight and just make sure that everyone had the opportunity to understand, because it's a little confusing. And that is the Medicare coordination. It was done the same way before the switch as it is now. It is very, very favorable. This is explained in our experts' declarations, and it is something for, again, that in the summary judgment proceedings, the plaintiffs responded to our facts about this with silence. They said nothing. So this is what we submit. The record establishes that this is how the Medicare coordination works. There's two kinds of systems. There's a full integration system and the carve-out. We use the full integration system now, and we used it before. And this is how it works, and bear with me, I'll make the math simple so I can do it. If you have a $100 medical bill, and Medicare pays 70% of it, so they pay $70, they're the first insurer, and you are on the EUTF's 90-10 plan, which is the only PPO plan that the EUTF has for retirees, the insurer that the ETF has contracted will cover the entire remaining $30, and you as a Medicare retiree will pay nothing. If I am on the same plan as an active employee, the 90-10 PPO plan, I will pay $10 for that same bill because I do not have someone covering it all the way. That's the way the Medicare coordination has always worked. They do. The retirees are receiving for free what the active employees pay for because of this.
Right. So I think we understand that, but doesn't that go to whether he can prove his case to show that that the plan is inferior? I mean, even Judge Castagnetti said in her ruling, which you challenge in your cross appeal if we get past his appeal. Retired employees are enrolled in separate health plans, some of which contain different services and inferior levels of coverage, co-pays, maximums, deductibles, and active employees receive. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the court's finding.
Right, which is why we challenged it in the event of further proceedings. But the thing to remember about this is every time you see those charts and it claims that, for example, making it very simplistic, that an active employee gets 90% and a retiree gets 80.
Right.
For all of the Medicare retirees, that 80 is actually 100. But every time you see that, that's leaving out the Medicare coordination. It's a huge part of how these plans are administered. Huge part. At the time of the summary judgment briefing, Medicare retirees outnumbered non-Medicare retirees by a 4-to-1 ratio. And I can represent to you that I've asked for updated data from the EUTF. That ratio is now 5-to-1. And demographics being what it is, it would not surprise me if that number kept going up. So the number of people that get 100 every time is a very, very large proportion of the class that Mr. Olson represents, where what they're getting, they get more, and they get for free what the active employees are paying for. So we have a hard time understanding how that could not be even greater than the parity they say they're asking for when what they get is 100%, 100% coverage.
So is the Medicare coverage comparable in parity with what active employees get?
The Medicare coverage, you mean Medicare by itself or Medicare the coordination?
Coordinated.
It's better, Your Honor, because if you're on a 90-10 plan with HMSA and you have both Medicare, then the state's plan is the secondary plan. And you put them together, and together they equal 100%.
I guess in terms of coverage of what you can get treated for.
What you get treated for? As far as I know, there's not that they are substantially equivalent, and the differences are not significant. Yeah. The difference is not significant. Judge Castagnetti's ruling, in fact, finds the retiree plans before and after the switch are substantially equivalent, even not taking Medicare into account. And we point that out, that as similar as she said they are, they're actually even more similar because the Medicare coordination was done in the same manner before the switch as after.
So as far as the Medicare retirees, the people who are covered by that Medicare coordinating plan, you would take the position that there is parity or using...
There's greater than parity. Okay. They have a better plan than I do.
Okay, and yeah. So is that now we're focusing just on the people who are not Medicare covered?
No, the only reason I'm highlighting that is because it's an incredibly important part of, it's not my understanding that that's all plaintiffs are pursuing. That's right. Not the case they brought. They brought it for all retirees.
Right.
That's the case they brought. The reason that we're talking about it is because when you look at all retirees, Medicare is a big part of how that's done and has always been since 1966, the year that Medicare started. So the entire history of the state providing health insurance back to the minute that Medicare began was to allow for this two insurances working together with a Medicare supplemental plan, which is done for now 5 out of 6 of the retirees.
Fundamentally what you're suggesting is that Judge Castagnetti correctly followed the Everson as her baseline for the law that would apply
yes.
to the facts of this case.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's where we started.
Mm-hmm.
And then your expert, Mr. Garner, and the other experts, or the other declarants, looked at not only Everson, but the Duncan analysis as to how they're going to apply the constitutional analysis to the facts. And what,
yes,
you're, what are you saying that the plaintiffs in their declarations in opposition did not address factually some of the key arguments that were proposed by Garner, and therefore those facts are concluded as a matter of law?
Yes, Your Honor. Then, okay, the two most important ones is actuarial equivalence and Medicare coordination, to which if you look at their summary judgment filings, they were silent. They had no response. In terms of Duncan...
But let me ask you this. I understand they didn't respond, but because they're in the nature of an expert opinion, mm-hmm, and as Judge Leonard said, Judge Castagnetti said, well, I'm looking at this and we talk about reasonableness.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't a trier of fact then simply reject those because it's an analysis and then they arrive at a conclusion and it's an expert's conclusion? Can't those simply be rejected by a trier of fact at a trial rather than at summary judgment?
I apologize. I'm not sure I understand the connection in your question between the reasonableness test and your question.
Well, she uses the word, it's reasonableness.
Yes.
She does find as one of the findings that this plan is inferior. That's one of the findings that she said. There was a diminishment and some of the benefits received are inferior.
Right. So because it's a summary judgment ruling, she's found that there's no, she doesn't say it this way, but there's no genuine issue of material fact as to that conclusion, is what I'm assuming. But okay. I think this gets back to what I said earlier, which is that when you have this test about reasonableness, about Duncan, about substantial equivalence, that part is part of the constitutional analysis.
It's not a contract analysis. It's a constitutional analysis.
It's because that's the claim.
And the Supreme Court does that as a matter of law.
Correct. And so the legal test from Duncan is a legal test. The only facts that would be material is what did the health fund provide to retirees and what did the EUTF provide to retirees. And I would submit those facts are not in contention. In fact, have never been. About Duncan, one important point. Mr. Alston argues that both Duncan and Ko'ohana'ohano are authority for his high watermark theory. That is incorrect. Duncan is analyzing substantial equivalence before and after a challenged event, exactly as we have suggested, exactly as Judge Castagnetti did, provides no authority for a high watermark or comparing to active employees. In the Ko'ohana'ohano, the issue was whether the source of the pension funds was protected by Article 16, Section 2. The portion that they're relying on is dicta. It's actually the summary of an Alaska opinion. It's not the holding of this court. So neither one of those things applies. If they're talking about high watermark also exposes, and to the extent they're relying on the union plans, you look at their summary judgment filings, they introduce no evidence about the union plans. Their theory at the beginning of the case, in summary judgment, and with the operative complaint, is comparing the current retirees to the current actives.
Right.
Not what some retiree used to get when they were an active before they retired in a union plan. Mm-hmm. There is no evidence on which they could make an argument premised on the union plan. So as far as we're concerned, that's just a non sequitur at this point. They've not introduced any evidence, or that's not even the theory of the case as they began it.
So the theory changed?
They did, Your Honor. They changed their, as far as we can tell, they changed it on appeal, which obviously, well, we don't particularly care for that. I see that my time is nearly finished, if I may conclude. Thank you. Your Honor, Everson defines the benefit, and it is the starting point, as we've discussed. It defines the benefit protected by Article 16, Section 2. The substantial equivalence test, which Judge Castagnetti took from Duncan, we believe provides the right level of balance between the protection that these benefits need and the flexibility that health benefits must have in the world, in the real world, right? We submit to you the Circuit Court correctly followed both the Everson definition of the benefit and the pulling analogous case law from other jurisdictions, and we ask that you affirm the order and judgment of the Circuit Court. Thank you.
Judges, any other questions?
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Ms. Iha is fundamentally wrong in her reading of the Everson case. What she wants you to believe is that in Everson, the Supreme Court said all that's protected is whatever package of benefits the state chooses to give to retirees. That's not what Article 16, Section 2 protects. That's not what the Supreme Court said was protected. what the Supreme Court said was protected was the package of health benefits that one gets a vested and accrued interest in during the lifetime of their work for the state. And when you become a retiree, you have a vested and protected right to that package of benefits. But there is nothing in Everson that suggests that you can have great benefits when you're an active worker and terrible benefits with your, when you're a retired worker. And you should just accept that because that's all the state chooses to provide to retirees.
So even if we agree with you on that, she also says that there's no genuine issue of material fact. They're not only equivalent, they're better.
Yeah, that's just nonsense. I'm sorry. Because the reality is, if you read her reply brief, over and over again, she says, our expert was wrong and their expert was right. And she comes in here and says that there wasn't a dispute. In fact, there was a very serious dispute. Our expert was saying, if you put the two pieces of the PEHF plan together and you look at that, it is a whole lot better than was ever provided under EETF. Their expert,
and again, that's without regard to the union plans, correct?
Yes, without regard to the union plans.
Which she agrees with.
Yes, and so you've got, in our expert's view, in a very detailed declaration with very detailed line-by-line analysis, benefit-by-benefit analysis, he says, this is how much better it was under PEHF than it is under UTF. Their fellow comes in and says, oh, these are accurate, you know, actuarially equivalent, and in fact, it's better now than it ever was, without any sort of line-by-line analysis. And I submit that, at a minimum, that presents a jury question, or not a jury question, a question that requires a trial, and we didn't get one. Judge Castagnetti, looking at only half of the PEHF benefits, said they're equivalent, and she forgot the basic, she forgot the major medical rider, which made it a whole lot better program for everybody.
Mr. Alston, just a quick question. Your skip about a jury trial. I know it's not going to be a jury trial.
Right.
But assuming what would the jury instruction look like?
What would the judge think of it? Mm-hmm. Yeah. If there was a jury instruction, then it would take off on the teachings of the Supreme Court in Kahala Hanahano and Duncan and Hammond and say, this is what you're entitled to. Now, Ms. Iha says, well, we can't rely on Chapter 87. We can't rely on any of that old law, but that is exactly what Article 16, Section 2 protects. The state doesn't get a chance to come in and say, well, when we said all these things about your benefits, both in statutes and in pamphlets, we had our fingers crossed. We were thinking we could change it at our whim whenever we wanted to as you approached and after you got to retirement.
But there is sort of a meeting of the minds here, I would say, on the substantial equivalence test.
Yes, there is. And then the question comes with respect to this issue of actuarial equivalence, whether it is appropriate or permissible to do what the PEHF never did, and that is to carve off the retirees and take that group of older and often sicker workers and say, we're going to come up with a plan that costs about the same, and we're going to call it actuarially equivalent, even though the benefits go down.
Okay, but isn't that your burden at trial to show that, I mean, actual equivalence, they can put on that evidence, but you have to show that the benefits went down for the group, right?
Right, and which we've done. I mean, I think if you cannot look at Mr. Paul Tom's declarations, and there's two, and Judge Castagnetti mentions only the first, but you cannot look at both of those declarations and go through the line-by-line comparison of every benefit and conclude that there is equivalence at all. And what Mr. Garner acknowledges that he did was carve off the retirees and had to refuse to give them the same benefits as active workers because of the caps. And that's where the problem arises. I mean, I think when he admitted that they could have, as they did with Kaiser, put everybody in a single underwriting pool and given everybody the same and better benefits for retirees, he was admitting that the EUTF actually was, you know, basically cheating the retirees for the benefit of the counties and the state because it was trying to get lower premiums for the active workers. And he's also, you know, when they come in and they say, we only did what the retirees wanted us to do, because a handful of retirees came and said, we don't want you to do anything that might cost us money. The reality is, under Article 16, Section 2, they can't adopt a plan that's going to cost the retirees money because the retirees were promised benefits for free.
At the beginning, you said there were three questions.
Yes.
That we have to address and that you were addressing. And the first one was, when do the benefits accrue and vest?
Right.
So I'd like the answers to the three questions.
Okay.
In one sentence or one word.
Yes.
When?
They accrue and vest when someone starts in the system and then reaches milestones which guarantee or provide the benefits.
Okay, so they accrue when they start in the system,
right.
But they can never go below the high water mark, is what you're saying, which was just the Sokoba's concurring opinion.
Right, correct.
Then the second question was, what accrues?
Right, and what accrues is, at minimum, we think, the benefits that existed during their active employment. And whether you look throughout that entire, say, 25 or 30-year career and look for the high watermark, or whether you look for what existed for active workers at the point of retirement, we win either way because we can show, with respect to the union plans, they had a very high watermark.
Right.
And on that score, it doesn't matter how the state administers the health system, the health benefit system, they don't get to change it because they decide it's too expensive. Under Article 16, Section 2. And Ms. Iha is exactly wrong by saying Article 16, Section 2 doesn't protect things that were covered by statute and benefits that were protected by statute.
No, but what she did say was that it was HMSA, or the third-party provider, the insurer, who came in and says, look, we're getting rid of this old major medical benefits plan and this base plan because that's not the model. And we all know that that's occurred throughout the industry. So what she's saying is, look, the state negotiated the best it could. Now, I realize that may be the question here is, well, what is the best?
And that's demonstrably false, because Mr. Garner says, we did that with respect to the Kaiser. Everybody's in one pool. With respect to HMSA, we got a better deal for the active workers, and we took the retirees and gave them some lesser benefits, but still, quote, equivalent, the actuarially equivalent, which I understand to mean it costs the same, but not the same benefits. And what 16.2 protects is benefits, not costs.
Right.
Whatever it costs, the state has to pay.
And that's
the point.
The last question you said was there an unconstitutional diminishment or impairment of the benefits?
Actually, my last question had to do with Judge Hefo's rulings.
Oh, okay.
That there were constitutional flaws, not just statutory flaws arising under 87A and the need.
Okay. Well, let's stick with Judge Castagnetti's decision.
Right.
What you're suggesting then, Mr. Alston, is that there is a question of fact here that was decided by the judge by a weighing of the evidence and making a decision, and that from the plaintiff's perspective, the case would need to be sent back based upon the constitutional analysis.
And the guidance that this court gives about when there's vesting and what level of benefits is protected.
Okay, because I understood Ms. Iha's argument to be that because this is a constitutional analysis, we could simply look at the experts' opinions or their declarations and take those portions that are undisputed because there are no material questions of fact on those. And because we're sitting as the Supreme Court, we can just simply decide this as a matter of law. And you're suggesting that even on a constitutional analysis, facts matter.
The facts matter. And I think if what she says today isn't what they say in their briefs. In their briefs, over and over again, they say our expert was wrong. And they say Judge Castagnetti got it right. Well, you can't say our expert was wrong and should be disregarded because he's wrong, and then say that the facts are undisputed. So I think that at one level there is a factual dispute that does need a trial. On the other hand, there are, when you read Paul Tom's declaration and you look at the line-by-line analysis, I think, frankly, the only reasonable conclusion is that, in fact, when you put the two parts of the PEHF program together, you can only think that it's better than the EUTF program. Let me talk a little bit about the Medicare coordination, and that is a red herring for two reasons. One, there are many thousands of non-Medicare retirees who aren't protected by this Medicare coordination. There are thousands of of dependents who aren't protected. With that, I'll stop. Are you saying 2 minutes?
No, you said two. Once you get to two, I want to let you finish.
Okay, thank you. Medicare, so it's a red herring because there are people who aren't covered by that. It's also a red herring because of the Kaiser analysis. They say, oh, well, we have to do this. We have to have this split system because of the Medicare coordination. And then you look at the Kaiser system where everybody's getting the same and they still have coordination. So it can't be that the split system for HMSA is driven by the Medicare coordination. That's just false.
Thank you, Mr. Alston. We'll take the matter under advisement.
Supreme Court trustee of the lawyers now adjourned.